Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It's Monday, September 16th. It's day three of a lockout of nurses at Kapi'olani. We take you out to the line of union members who are gathered in front of the medical center. We hear more reaction to the report on the Maui wildfires from the State Attorney General's office that released it last week on what led up to the disaster, the deadliest in U.S. history. And the garden aisle pushes the artificial intelligence envelope online, and people are doing a double take. Is that for real? The Hawaii Media Council weighs in on the use of AI technology to present the news headlines. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Legal lockout or illegal lockout? A rare move to lock out nurses at Kapi'olani Medical Center for women and children following a one-day strike move into its third day. This morning, tour buses brought in traveling nurses to cover the open staff positions under the watchful eye of security. On Friday, some 600 members of the Hawaii Nurses Association walked off the job in protest over their stalled labor talks on a new contract. The nurses were locked out of their jobs when they tried to return on Saturday. HPR's Mark Liddell captured some audio from the line on Friday of cars honking, cowbells clanging, and nurses on the line.
That's why we stand together. That's why it's not just nurses, you know, it's workers, it's other workers, it's other unions, you know, and then our elected officials coming over and telling us their support, and they're here, and they understand. Right? Today is about the retaliation.
HNA leader Rosalie Agassiou was back out on the line this morning. The members took yesterday to regroup following the lockout. Members are planning to march on the downtown offices of Hawaii Pacific Health tomorrow. Here's Agassiou.
We now have nurses that are not working, so they want to, in fact, we had a town hall, met who could come out. We have daily town halls, it's all about communication. They want to be out in front of the hospital for presence. We were trying to ease it up for them, but they're like, no, we want to be out there. So it's a demonstration. There had to be some confirmation of that. The employer thought maybe it was picketing, but no, it's a peaceful demonstration.
What's the difference?
With a picket, you have sticks, you're trying to stop traffic, it's a stoppage. But with a peaceful demonstration, it fits perfectly for the nurses. Peaceful out there. They're demonstrating out there that, this is an illegal lockout and, it's wrong. Everything, it's wrong.
And management says it's not illegal. It's perfectly within their right as part of the whole bargaining process.
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on, that unfair labor practice charge. And as you know, it was about retaliation. And I don't know, actions speak louder than words at times. And when you look at it, this is the biggest form of retaliation you can think of. This is unheard of. Everybody across, unions, nurses, just the general public is just shocked at how this could be even allowed. It's just, it is. It's like retaliation at its worst.
Yeah, some might look at this and say this is a bit heavy-handed because we haven't seen a healthcare facility use this mechanism of locking out its workers, particularly in a healthcare setting that's a little unsettling for people.
Yes, and with the nurses, it's always, always about the patient. They stood out here, they knew that this is what it's gonna take to say, hey, what we're doing in the past 3 years has been wrong. And what now is, hey, we have to make a change. And you know what? They talk about wages and everything like that, but you know what? If they could just hire more nurses, put that money there and make sure that there's enough staffing, a lot of the nurses that are out here would be okay with that. That's the general output. It's like, hey, we need more nurses and we need to be able to retain them. You always see, in our shirt, right? Retain, recruit, respect. the employer has put a lot of energy in, you know, recruiting, getting, you know, new nurses in, and it's fantastic, but we want to protect them. We know that they're young nurses, they're new nurses that come probably from another profession, but we want to be able to retain them. And I think that's been a problem. Even to this day, like, they could choose to make the movements to try to retain the nurses we have. Like our newborn intensive care unit, our baby unit, they lost 15 nurses in 1 month. Whether it be moving to a different unit, out of the state, you know, for whatever reason, that's 15, that's a lot. There's about maybe about 150 nurses in that unit altogether. So you have to replace that. But why are they leaving? A lot of them is like, hey, the environment, it's toxic. It's not very conducive to, you know, wanting to stay. But the ones that you see out here on the line, they are committed. They are committed. Even while Saturday we walked up to the, you know, employer and they told us, don't come in, and they locked us out, those nurses were committed. I turned around, I look in their eyes, and they said, They wanted to come in. They wanted to go inside and take care of the patients. So we wanted to hear it from the employer that we do not want you to come in.
And then how does this work? Because I know management has said that at the end of this proposed contract that the nurses would be making $130,000 base salary for a 3-day work day. And, you know, for folks in other professions, or let's say hotel workers who have to work several jobs to make ends meet, you know, how does that work? You know, what kind of work day are we talking about? And is there mandatory overtime for nurses? Because if you can't fill those open slots, you know, what then, right? Because you've got to cover if you've got those standards.
It's interesting because someone showed me a picture and it shows what it's all about. So basically, like we said about retaining people, they leave because mandatory overtime, lots, like in the past 3 years, they've relied on it. In the past, when we talked about it, because the employer would want to change it or whatnot, they always said, it's an emergency, you know, a hurricane comes through, a fire comes through, that's it. But there's been a lot of that. And we understood, COVID came through, okay, we will do what we can. Now it's, you know, it's kind of fizzled out a little bit. So the nurses are saying, why are we still using mandatory overtime? It's not an emergency. And then you have this on-call situation. We used to use that for, like, you know, you call them in only for emergency. Well, if you look at the different hospitals, which I think is very interesting, for Kapilani, Queens, and Wilcox, who are negotiating right now, on-call has been abused. So they are calling people in to staff the units, and that's not right. They're there for emergent, they're backup, but they're using them to staff the units. Even, like, for instance, transport team, I'm a transport team nurse. So instead of replacing an open spot with a nurse that has a position, they've been utilizing the on-call system. So now you have nurses that are not only working the 3 days, they are on-call another 3 days. So, you know, and it's hard because nurses in general want to be there for the community. As a transport nurse, we fly. If there's anybody like on the Big Island, the Maui, we want to be available because if you're late 2, 3, 4 hours, a patient, a baby, a child could be affected.
And then give us the 10,000-foot view. You mentioned the other hospitals. Where are we at in contract talks with the other HPH facilities?
Okay, so I know Wilcox. Wilcox has just, they've been expired, so they are also working, trying to get through negotiations as well. The community has been very supportive over there. They're just building the community because it's difficult, right? They're out in Kauai. They're not as in touch over here, but we are there with them. We are, you know, we'll provide the same amount of support. So, and they have the same battle. It's the same battle. And it's harder because to live in Kauai, it also very expensive. One thing that it's interesting that the employer doesn't bring up, and what I've been hearing a lot, is nurses, sometimes they're the sole caregiver of their families. Single parents, they're utilizing that to raise their family and on their own. So you got childcare expenses that you have to think about. And a lot of it is multi-generational, right? In Hawaii, you might have 2 or 3 families living under this one nurse, and that money that they make is helping those families.
Where are we at then with the other unions? You said Straub.
Straub will be opening up their contract next year. Queens is still in bargaining as well. Their contract expired last month or the month before. They've been expired for a little bit, so they're still negotiating. Wilcox also, they're negotiating as well.
And Palimomi is not represented by HNA?
No, Palimomi is a non-bargaining unit.
Does the union have a strike fund?
Yes, the union has a strike fund through OPIU. We're also looking at other alternatives for our members, because that's the main thing. We just want to support our members during this.
People hope that you folks will go back to the table.
Yes.
Soon.
Where we put across the table to the employer this Thursday. We're open for in-person. We would like to do it all day. You know, the nurses are ready, and we hope in-person, because we have 600 nurses that are available and want to see bargaining. We've been very, very transparent. They get to come on Zoom. They get to come in person. So they know what's happening. You know, the decisions that they're making on the other side is affecting all these nurses that will be there.
You folks are going to be marching tomorrow to the headquarters?
Yes. We're going to be starting off at the state capitol. We've invited, you know, community members, and we're going to walk over to HPH, Harbor Court. And then we're going to be doing some demonstrations. There's some actions we've been working with and talking with our fellow unions, like the ILWU, Teamsters. So there's interesting, because the unions are really like coordinating efforts together, because this is important. What they've done out here is really like eye-opening to everybody, not just nurses across the country. What I've heard this morning, it's just firing up in the country. It's now like the unions, just people that work here in the state, you know, you could get locked out if you decide, you know, we don't agree with what the employer is offering.
And ILWU and Teamsters represent workers here at Kapi'olani?
Correct.
That was HNA leader Rosalie Augasiu. Hawaii Pacific Health says it is aware of the planned march to their offices. We are scheduled to talk to management tomorrow. Nurses say they believe the hospital census count is about average, and we're told the hospitals deliver about 400 babies a month. A sticking point in the talks is said to be staff-to-patient ratio and language about mandatory overtime. This is believed to be the first time in Hawaii history that hospital management has decided to lock out its members over a dispute over a new working contract. The very first nurses' strike in Hawaii was 20 years ago. Close to 500 nurses from four hospitals walked off the job back in 1974. No cause yet on what started last year's deadly Maui wildfires. That federal report from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is still pending. But the state attorney general did release part two of its review on the response to the disaster, which killed 102 people and left thousands homeless. HPR's Ashley Mizuo joins us with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the state really was flat-footed.
Right, yeah. The bottom line of the Phase 2 report was, you know, we were just completely unprepared for a disaster like this. It offered a series of recommendations, this Phase 2 report. There's over 100 recommendations in the report, and it can seem a little overwhelming. But I spoke with Hawaii Wildfire Management Organization Executive Director Elizabeth Pickett, and she helped kind of put these recommendations into context.
In a system where the culture shifts, and everybody's alert and awakened to the risk that we face, and they're all doing their part, it doesn't seem so daunting. It just seems normal. Like in other places where they know they have fire risk, of course the codes have wildfire-related safety measures in them. Of course land managers are managing their vegetation. Of course there's funding put toward a state fire marshal's office. We got fire issues. We got to figure this out. You know, it is common and best practice for the whole system to be aware of fire and building it into what they do.
And that was one thing, you know, the Attorney General, Ann Lopez, while she was presenting the report, kept emphasizing that this report is not meant to say that this is one person's fault or one agency's fault. And, you know, reading the report, I see what she's saying, because there's so many forks in the road where we could have prevented or significantly decreased the level of disaster, that by the time the actual fire started, there should have been so many more things in place. Things far back as like city planning with the width of roads, or things as small as, you know, making sure tree branches aren't hanging over people's houses and their roofs. And so that's what many of the recommendations in the report are centered around. It's prevention. And there's not to say that there weren't plans, because there were plans and warnings from groups like the Hawaii Wildfire Management Organization about how West Maui could have managed its fire risk. But, you know, the vast majority of those warnings and proposed plans were not put into place. place. There was, you know, little vegetation management, with the exception of the Department of Transportation clearing some of the roads. You know, Department of Land and Natural Resource, they manage 25% of the land in Hawaii, but only 1% of the state's budget is actually allocated to carrying out those mandates. And so
there's an imbalance there.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the majority of homes in the area lacked defensible space, which is like this buffer created, cleared of flammable debris between structures. You know, private lands were unused or unmanaged and went fallow that used to be used for agricultural uses and now are just kind of left. And, you know, invasive grasses and things that are very flammable have, you know, developed on these lands. And these are the types of things that the report kind of outlines that were preventable, you know, prevention issues.
So to be clear, though, the Attorney General didn't really have staff that so much did this analysis, but they contracted out with an independent party.
The report was done by the Fire Safety Research Institute, but it was commissioned by the Attorney General. Other things that the report outlined were, you know, out-of-date building codes. Maui was using the 2006 edition of the International Residential Building Code. You know, I did a deep dive into why building codes are important and all the problems facing adopting new ones, so you can look that up on our website if you're interested. But the key is that, you know, new codes in theory equals safer structures, likely more fire resistant. You know, the report talks about how roads were narrow, limited in and out, so with high daily traffic, cars parked on both sides of the street, making it really difficult for you to get in and out, including for first responders. And there was an instance where, you know, the firefighters were trapped and they had to abandon their equipment. And then when we go on to the response side, once the fire has broken out, you know, there seems to be a lack of coordination between the Hawaiian Electric Company, Maui Police Department, Maui Fire Department, and Hawaii Emergency Management that, you know, really led to a lagged response to the fire itself. And also a lack of communication to the public. You know, 87% of people said they didn't receive a text notification from the county about high winds. And out of the 5 sirens located off Highway 30 near that coastline where the fire broke out, there were only 2 that were actually operable.
So there's lots of blame to spread around. It wasn't just one particular agency.
Right. It was so many series of different things, you know, dating back as, you know, city planning.
All compounded.
Right. All compounded into this horrible disaster. And it talks about, the report also talks about the perception of risk in the state, the perception of fire risk in the state prior to the Lahaina fires. And they say that people didn't perceive it to be a big risk. And we've learned that in previous reporting. You know, for example, we spoke with Hawaii Department of Transportation Director Ed Sniffen about evacuation routes this summer. And he said just 5 years ago, the Department of Transportation conducted a risk assessment that ranked, you know, the 8 common natural disasters, which include flooding, hurricanes, rockfalls, by potential impact on the state highway system. And, you know, director said that wildfires ranked 7th out of 8, one spot up from the bottom of that list. And now because of Lahaina, it's towards the top.
Wow.
Pickett, you know, she pushed back on the idea too that everyone in the state had a low risk perception when it comes to wildfire, because prior to the Maui wildfires last year, there were 16 FireWise communities across the state, which is this program that's facilitated by the Hawaii Wildfire Management Organization, which helps residents prepare and protect their neighborhoods from fire. There are 24 FireWise communities now, and, you know, many of those FireWise communities are neighborhoods that have had close calls with wildfires in the past, which led them to action when they noticed the lack of investment from government agencies. So they really took fire management into their own hands, and you can see direct impacts of this. But really what it is a change in mindset that needs to happen at a policy level, that fire prevention is a priority. And, you know, Pickett hopes that these reports will continue the momentum needed to make better policies and actually implement them statewide.
So really it was just a lackadaisical approach to all this. The information was out there, but we just didn't have that sense of urgency or believe that the risk was that high.
Right. It's just a lack of investment in the issue.
Okay. And so, these recommendations came out, you know, what do we do now?
Yeah. So Governor Josh Green has asked the Attorney General's office to create a list of, you know, top 10 recommendations from this phase 2 report. I spoke with Senate President Ron Kochiu, who says he's expecting a package of bills from the administration that the legislature can take up in January.
We need to look at building codes. Are there more fire retardant building materials that would be best practices to use? Are there design and construction that we should be looking at? And how do we ensure between the state and the county that we are trying to build back in a way that would ensure better safety in the event of another fire?
You know, it was interesting. Last week we talked to a builder of homes made of hemp, and he says that material is fire resistant, right. Which was interesting. So if, you know, the county can look at what's out there, what are the options, and build back better.
Yeah, and I think also a lot of these recommendations will require lots of monetary investment from the state. And meanwhile, you know, revenue is down, and likely the legislature will be faced with a tough economic year. So I asked Senate President whether some of this would get passed. And he said it would likely be less than what the state will now have to pay in settlements. And you can't put a dollar amount on the number of lives that would be saved by that. So here's what he said.
If we can resolve the lawsuit with the settlement offer, it's a substantial amount of money. That just reminds you that shouldn't we put that money in investing in protecting versus deferring and then having a catastrophic event and paying more than what the prevention would have been.
Right. And so the attorney general says that the next report will probably be out by the end of the year, and that the ATF report, which is the cause and origin of the fire, is in the final stages, but they haven't determined one that will be released yet.
Yeah, lots of eyes will be on that one. But thanks so much,
Thank
Ashley.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Ashley Mizzuo reporting on the release of the state attorney general's Maui report. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, recognizing September as Suicide Prevention Month. Learn more about risk factors, warning signs, and how to help at afsp.org.
The news and music you hear on HPR are supported in part by nearly 200 local organizations that choose to reinforce their brand with us. Mahalo to Dr. Peter Moginis Mark at UH Manoa. Hawaii Life and Blue Note Hawaii. They believe, just as you do, in the power of public radio. See a full list of our underwriters at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Maui.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omau, okaholabe, ohawai. Today we're taking a look at the Hawaii-based musical group, which featured not only one, but two members with ties to Hawaii Public Radio, known for playing a mixture of Latin jazz, salsa, merengue, and cha-cha. Cache featured Ray Cruz on percussion and a rotating lineup of other musicians to help round up the lineup. The band was known for their own original tunes and for covers of songs including Frankie Valli's My Eyes Adored You and Rhythm of the Night. Cache released a self-titled recording in the summer of 1993 and became well known for their weekly sets at venues including the Black Orchid in Restaurant Row. As mentioned, the band included a host
of HPR's Latin Beat, Ray Cruz, as well as another of our station's on-air hosts. So, for the Backyard Quiz question, we want to know the name of this multi-talented individual. Do you know who it is? As a hint, we'll tell you this HPR host sings lead and backup vocals. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know this bit of HPR trivia. First one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
In the darkness, let there be light. HPR is the spotlight that shines upon community voices, fresh ideas, and music selections that dare to venture deep. May you find HPR illuminating, inspiring, and informative. Best of all, you help power this light source that's HPR, an independent nonprofit. Start with a $10 a month donation. Donate today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, this is Zilla Barbosa, host of Bridging the Gap. Join me for an immersive evening of eclectic music featuring a blend of Brazilian jazz, indie, electronic, and other diverse genres. That's Bridging the Gap tonight at 10, here on HPR One.
You're listening to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Or maybe not. Would you be able to tell if I were a real person or a fake voice created by artificial intelligence? Well, followers of Kauai's newspaper, The Garden Isle, were recently introduced to news readers Rose and James, the paper's newest hires. Take a listen to a recent clip from the show called TGI Today.
Welcome to TGI Today, Kauai Island's only live newscast powered by AI. TGI Today focuses on local and relevant news content you can only get from the Garden Island. I'm James, and with me is Rose. Join us as we bring you the in-depth stories behind the headlines right here on TGI Today. On today's show, we'll cover stories about sign waivers bringing attention to suicide prevention, The Point and Hilton Grand Vacations helping build homes in Waimea, and the soaring home sales in July. Before we start, a big mahalo to Long's Drugs for sponsoring today's newscast. Visit your local Long's Drugs for your everyday needs and continue to make Long's part of your day.
You know, we reached out to Long's Drugs, who told us that they were unaware of their logo being used in the AI-generated TGI Today video. Long's has a sponsorship agreement in place with the Garden Isle's owner, Oahu Publications, Inc. The conversation's Maddie Bender wanted to better understand how these AI newscasters were created and the use of bots around the world. She spoke with technology journalist Matthew Galt, who wrote a story for the website 404 Media about these AI newscasters and Kalido, the Israeli company that created them.
They look pasty to me. Their skin kind of looks sallow and their mannerisms don't track as human. They look like animated GIFs where they're kind of repeating the same motions and facial expressions over and over again. It's funny, one of the commenters, I think on YouTube, every single time one of these comes out, goes below the video and points out that James makes the same motion with his hands repeatedly and that it's very distracting. And then once you see that, you can't unsee it. That's all you're looking at is just James' hands kind of coming apart and coming back together. It almost looks like they're on a repeated loop.
If we can't know for sure how this specific case, these avatars are being created, do you have any insight as to what that process usually looks like.
I mean, it's a lot like making an avatar for a video game. So the way these avatars are typically created is through a process called using a generative adversarial network, which is kind of like how large language models and image generation works, where there's a large database of pictures of humans and a computer kind of slaps all this stuff together and creates what I would call is like an amalgamation of all of those different people.
What, if anything, makes this notable?
Well, there aren't very many of these, actually. So that's one of the things that stands out. You know, we've got, there's what's happening in Beijing. There is a company called Channel One, which, as far as I know, is still kind of in its beta phase. And its pitch is that it's going to create a personalized news broadcast for an individual or a company based on their needs. And then Russia Today is doing something like this in Latin America, where they're using AI broadcasters. So it's notable because it's the first time that I've seen it in the U.S. And it's also, it's a small local paper. This is not as if ABC suddenly premiered an AI avatar, right? This is a company and a paper that normally would not have any kind of news broadcaster at all. And it's what they're doing really is just kind of reading ChatGPT summaries of what the four journalists have fed into the machine. I don't know who this is for, you know? Like, I think if you're someone that's already reading the paper and you're getting the Garden Island, I can't imagine that you also then want to watch a 20-minute YouTube video of someone reading that stuff to you. It's strange. And for people that haven't watched it, it is very cheap looking and cheap sounding. The voices are, you know, one of the great things about broadcasters is that there's a voice that kind of soothes you and draws you in, and you build up a parasocial relationship with them. You're not going to build up a parasocial relationship with James or Rose. They don't sound or look human. There's an uncanny valley effect that's going to keep you at a distance from them. And the information you're getting from them is not enough, and it's more efficiently consumed in other ways.
Did you happen to look into any of the content that the two avatars are saying? Your impression is that it's like ChatGPT or AI chatbot summaries of Garden Island articles, but I'm wondering about like hallucination or whether there could be anything factually that the content is getting wrong.
So that's one of my big concerns. And this is one of the questions that I, in the several attempts to try to talk to Kalido and TGI and OPI, that was my number one question is like, how do you know that this thing's not hallucinating? What are the guardrails, et cetera? So just based on the outputs, like what they're saying and the stories that I have seen on the website, Kalido has some sort of proprietary LLM that is similar to ChatGPT that is generating the script based on what is being written in those articles. A lot of the stuff is word for word. It does miss things, though. I didn't see anything that was egregiously, like, completely incorrect. But, like, one of the big stories was about a local church that does a Labor Day lunch. It has done it for the past 43 years. It's a big tradition. It left some of the information out about one of the women that they were talking about, who she's like an important figure in the church and sits on this veterans board and is involved in a VA hospital. And like, they just kind of characterize her as someone who was there and this is what she said about it. And that's like, that's not a hallucination, but it's just kind of, it's something that an LLM doesn't understand the nuance and the context of who this person is when they're repeating the story, right?
Yeah. And it's making it more generic than it could have been.
Exactly. It's kind of, it's stripping, like all of this, it's stripping the humanity out of everything. This probably would not exist if it were not cheap and easy to produce, right? Because making a daily news show is hard. It's hard. You know this. You live it every day. It's a lot of work. It's labor. And I think that's like overall, that's one of the big pieces of the AI story is it's not going to go away because it is too tantalizing for companies to reduce their bottom line by cutting out as much labor as possible and replacing it with automated systems. I think that they will find that it is far less profitable than they were expecting, and that the costs of these systems are going to be shocking when everything is said and done. But we're going to have to go through the corporations trying to make this work for a while before it kind of falls apart. And unfortunately, more people are going to lose their jobs. More journalists are going to lose their jobs. And there's going to be more stuff like this. There's going to be more Roses and Jameses out there.
Are there any questions that you still have?
I have so many. Something we talked about earlier, we didn't really dive into, is like, how is this fact checked? Kalito's website claims that they had that there's a human overseeing the entire process. How does that work? What does it look like? What did this thing cost? What does it cost? And what could that money have been spent on in that newsroom instead of this? I think my last parting shot would be that, like, I follow news about conflict a lot. And the Pacific is a very important part of that beat, and that there's a lot of amazing coverage that is happening, that is being done every day by real journalists who are flesh and blood and alive, and that the publications under OPI are producing wonderful work, and that it's disappointing to see them also make this decision.
That was tech journalist Matthew Galt talking to HPR's Maddie Bender. We also got a statement from the Star Advertisers Union about the parent company's new exploits in AI. It said that two Star Advertiser reporters were given a demonstration of the technology, but they raised concerns about its use. They also said, "We think that there is a place for AI in the newsroom, but that, quote, this feels like a step backward in maintaining trust. We think it's unlikely the community will embrace James or Rose as Kama'aina," end quote. We'll have more on the story right after a short break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Scientists in Africa are working to dispel a myth that dementia isn't a problem on the continent. With Africa's elderly population set to triple in the next 30 years, experts are saying the continent is unprepared for the spike in people with dementia and that the need to improve access to proper treatment and care is urgent. That story and more global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Pacific American Lumber on Oahu, offering wood flooring from UA Floors. Its Hawaiian collection of engineered wood features mango and monkey pod from Hawaii Island. PACAMLumber.com.
And now it's time to play out the backyard quiz answer. Earlier, we told you about the Hawaii band Cache, which featured a couple of members with ties to Hawaii Public Radio. Mostly active in the early 90s, the group was known for playing a high-energy mixture of Latin jazz, salsa, merengue, and cha-cha. The band released a self-titled recording in 1993 and once won top honors at a Latin Battle of the Bands. Though some of the musicians rotated in and out, the core band members were Carlos Negron on the trumpet, bassist Jim Cook, Hitomi Fukui on keyboards, and HPR's Ray Cruz on percussion. Now for today's quiz, we asked you to name the other HPR host who sang lead and backup vocals for the band. That would be, drumroll please, Brazilian experience host Sandy Sukiyama, who, on top of being a performing vocalist, is an ethnomusicologist, linguist, and an educator. You may have even been one of her students at Roosevelt High School. And congrats to our winner, Ralph Toyama from Mo'ili Ili. You got it right. He shared that he knew the answer because Sandy does lots of good music in the community, so he thought it was a good guess. Yes, you got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, committed to the people of Hawaii, working to help keep workplaces safe and protect employees' rights. More by searching HIOSH.
When you support HPR, you support storytelling that illuminates understanding.
Our obligation was to each other, and the unwritten rule was this. We all come back or nobody comes back.
My son was in the Air Force and he's a wounded warrior. He was severely injured in Afghanistan at just the precious age of his early 20s.
We hear stories that remind us of our humanity.
This was something that happened, as they say, a normal reaction to abnormal circumstances.
My service in combat, my service in Vietnam, probably is the singular most event or experience that I had that put me on a path to where I am today.
Help HPR uplift more community voices. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Return now to our story about the Garden Islands' use of artificial intelligence generated newscasters. Gerald Kato was a real life newscaster. Full disclosure, I worked with him at KITV as a broadcaster. He also worked as a political reporter for the Star, for the Honolulu Advertiser. Kato is also a retired University of Hawaii at Manoa journalism professor and a member of the Media Council Hawaii. He came into our studios to give us another perspective on AI in journalism.
I look at this and it seems like a novelty right now. It's very a rough kind. You can tell it's AI. It's almost cartoonish. And the pronunciation of Hawaiian words are still something that needs to be worked on. But I think it should be some concern to all of us because it is, what is AI? It's not real. It's artificial. And, you know, we who have been journalists work in an environment, we deal with reality. Real journalists deal with reality, truth. And I think, you know, there's reason for a lot of us to be concerned about artificial intelligence anchors, artificial intelligence voices, artificial intelligence combined with deep fakes. They're not true. And that runs contrary to everything we believe as journalists. So I think it's something of some concern. Now, having said that, you know, I recognize that artificial intelligence can be a very useful tool for journalists, especially in a more mundane task of putting together routine stories, statistics, and things of that nature. But in terms of presenting the news, writing the news, reporting the news, I think that needs real intelligence. Not artificial one. I think there's reason to be concerned about this move into artificial intelligence on the Garden Island.
As an example, you know, I was out covering the rally over there, you know, at the Hilton Hawaiian Village, where ILWU was out there supporting Local 5. And it's one thing, you know, if you were to write up a story based on the press releases that are generated over this, but to actually be there on the hotel premises and watch the interaction of the visitors that are there at the hotel and watching this play out. You just pick up these nuances that you won't get from a AI story.
Sure, that's why real journalists are so important. You know, you need people on the ground who can do the analysis, who can be your eyes and ears of the public who's not there. if it's just a matter of picking up a news release from somebody, anybody could do that. You feed it into a computer and, okay, it spits out a story. But I think this community, news consumers generally, deserve a lot better. And that's why I think we should give some pause to using artificial intelligence. We should all start to think about how we use it in the news. I think, as I said, you know, there may be a place for artificial intelligence as a tool, not as a replacement for journalists reporting. It's a cheap way to put out the news.
So how should newsrooms be preparing for this if they haven't already?
Well, I think newsrooms need to start engaging in a conversation with their staff about how and when use of artificial intelligence would be appropriate and how the company, the institution, intends to use AI as a tool so that everybody's clear on what the ethics will be. You don't want to have a situation in which AI is producing the news and AI ultimately determines what your ethics for using AI becomes. And that's a real thing. You know, you can go to a AI product and ask it, what's the ethics of this? And they'll crank out something for you. You don't want to be in that situation. I think real people need to engage in real conversations about what and how we use AI and what kind of bright lines we're going to draw, because news is, it's important for us as journalists and news people to retain our credibility so that people don't start thinking, well, you know, I wonder if that's true. I wonder if that person I'm seeing on the broadcast station, is that a real person?
Or not.
Or yeah. Not. Or is the voice I'm hearing, is that a real voice? Or is something generated by some machine?
So we should be talking about policies to help guide us. Because this is coming pretty fast. I mean, I went to a conference a year ago, and as an example, we were using ChatGPT to generate stories, and I put out there Lahaina wildfires. And to see the story that they were generating, I was aghast. They had people in down jackets, you know, in houses, and you're like, wait a minute, this is not Hawaii. And so, yeah, it's a little scary, but it is moving at a very intense rate. Yeah,
and that's why I say, you know, we need to engage in conversation now, because it's evolving so quickly. You know, the advent of the Kauai avatars is still rather crude presentation. But, you know, I had mentioned to you earlier, I had been in China a couple of years ago, and just when China was about to unveil its first AI anchor. And it was good. I mean, you know, it was pretty good presentation.
Polished.
Very polished. And that was a couple of years ago. They've been working on this to the point where, you know, they can use a real anchor, use his features, his face, and make it seem like it's really him or her on the air. And so, you know, why do we need a human being? This avatar can be on 24 hours a day, and he's our anchor. And we don't have to pay them 24 hours a day.
Yeah. So sadly, though, this is moving at a very fast clip. And we need to be ready to have these difficult conversations.
You need to be ready and have that difficult conversation about journalism ethics, about how you deal with it on a labor situation. I mean, can't get intellectual property. Can somebody just come along and say, well, you know, the company just say, well, Catherine, we're going to put your voice in a computer, and we don't really need you to voice this story. We've got it on AI. You probably would object to that, as many others would, because your voice, your knowledge of the community, they're all part of your intellectual property. So these are issues, serious issues that need discussion. You can't just ignore it and hope it'll go away. Because, you know, it'll get worse over time. And I think erode journalistic credibility here and wherever it's in, put to use. So you need some, you need to begin the conversation about how, when, where, immediately.
I used to like to say, I want to use technology more than it uses me. I think we're probably at a juncture where it could really go the other way.
We sure are. We don't want technology to be dictating to us how we do things, why we do things, and the ethics. I wouldn't want a machine defining for me what the public interest is in terms of news and information.
Okay, so people just need to be on guard and be discerning about whatever they're listening to and watching and reading, for that matter.
Yeah. They sure do. And in this day and age, you need to be very aware of where your news and information is coming from and the credibility of it. News literacy is something that I fully endorse.
And that was Gerald Kato of the Hawaii Media Council. And we did reach out to get the views of another veteran journalist. Jan Ten Bruggenkate is the former Kauai bureau chief for the Honolulu Advertiser, who still lives on the Garden Isle. He doesn't fault the company for investing in technology, but he lamented that, you know, back in the day, there would be at least four journalists covering the county council meetings. And he says that today you would be lucky to have one reporter in the room. He wishes that more resources were directed in the news gathering. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, a convention kicks off on the Big Island. We hear from Kuhio Lewis from the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement about what's in store. Have a story idea to share with us? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Google, Apple, or Spotify. I'm Catherine Cruz, really. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.